Welcome, everybody, to the Locked On Lakers podcast. I'm Anthony Irwin. I am joined by Pete Zayas. Pete, I just played 30 holes of golf. I might fall asleep mid-show. I'm not gonna lie. My friends had me up. My friend is from, or not from, but he lives in Boston, so he's like used to waking up early. My other friend does work a lot on the East Coast, and he's used to waking up really early. So they're like, "Yeah, let's play golf this morning. It's 7 a.m. And I'm like, "What? Who does that?" But we have a great show today. I'm really excited about where this is going to go. Thanks for working your schedule out so that we could do this. Today's show, we've analyzed the Lakers, and we will continue to analyze the Lakers. And in the coming weeks, I have a series coming out, or that I'm going to do for the show, that will be completely strong Lakers analysis. But today, we're just going to have some fun. We're going to be nostalgic, and we're going to take a trip down memory lane. And Pete is a huge Laker fan. I am a huge Laker fan. So we're going to take everybody through our favorite five. I have an honorable mention, but our five best non-title moments. And we'll just see where it takes us. We'll wax poetic. I should have cracked a beer for this. I'm regretting that at this point, but I'll let you start since I've been rambling. You guys know where to find the show. Let's go right into this. I don't have mine really list. It's not top 1 through 5, but what's the first item on your list here?
So the first one, yeah, this is not necessarily, I mean, it's my favorite of all time, but it's of the five, is Nick Van Exel's game winner in the last game the Lakers played in the Boston Garden.
Oh, man.
This is 1995. So a bit of context and history, especially for younger Laker fans or Laker fans that don't always know the entirety of the Lakers-Celtics rivalry. Maybe there are a couple pieces in what I'm about to say that kind of informs it a little bit. We think about the Celtics as being, they just killed it and they dominated in the 60s and in the 70s and won all of those titles. And that's true. And we don't think as the Lakers as a peer of theirs. And in a way, because the Celtics did win those, they were peerless. But what a lot of younger Lakers fans don't realize is how close a lot of those were, and the Lakers could never get over the hump.
Like, so these weren't brutal.
It wasn't like always like 4 or 5 game series where they would play and the Celtics would just run them off of the floor. They would lose in like heartbreaking game sevens at home, and just like and in the Boston Garden, there was always like a legend of like the leprechauns, right, would make fortune go the Celtics' way in the key moment that would make them pull off a victory in the last seconds. So it wasn't just like they were killing the Lakers, right? But the Lakers could never get over that hump. In 85, Magic hit the jump hook in game 4 or game 5 mm-hmm. that essentially sealed the series. That wasn't the game that won it, but that exercised the demons of the Boston Celtics. That was the first time something freaking went right for the Lakers in Boston Garden, right?
Yeah.
It was when Magic hit that shot. And so I'm not quite old enough to remember that, and that was a finals game, so that doesn't qualify for our list. But 95, fast forward 10 years later, that was when the Boston Garden was closing down. That was the last game the Lakers played in there. And the garden floor, the parquet floor, that was like a different type of wood than other gyms used, and they had it all the way up until they left. It had like dead spots on
it.
It was just
Bird
this, like,
Bird memorized the dead spots on there and made sure to like forced offensive players to those spots or whatever. But yeah, go ahead.
So yeah, absolutely. So it was just this like mystical place, right, where a house of horrors for the Lakers over the years. And the Lakers were down by 118 to 117, and they had a sideline inbounds play with like 2.3 seconds left. And they passed the ball to Van Exel, who caught it. He was facing the sideline and away from the basket about 30 feet from the hoop. And he hit a turnaround 30-footer with a hand in his face to hit the three to win the game. Lakers go nuts. One of my favorite parts of that is Del Harris, who was the Lakers coach at the time, who was this like old white dude with like salty hair, right? Like, and
the whitest hair I've ever seen.
Yeah, and he's just like the picture definition of like an old white dude. And like Van Exel hits that shot, and it wasn't like he drew up a great play or anything, but he hits that shot, and the camera cuts to Del Harris, and he's like, "Yeah, that's right, MF." Like he's like acting all gangster, right? Like, and Van Exel's, you know, getting mobbed by his teammates. He's like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And so for me, that was a great moment in like kind of shutting the door on a new era of like the Lakers maintaining dominance, right? Where the Lakers and Celtics battled in the 80s, but since then it's been way more Lakers than it has been Celtics. So it was kind of like that final nail in the coffin of the old Celtics leprechauns. How about you, man? What's your
Nick Van Exel's the greatest. Like, I just not obviously not the actual GOAT or whatever like that, but I effing love Nick Van Exel. He was so much fun. So much fun. All right. My my favorite memory is not necessarily a specific memory, you know, any specific night or whatever. But my grandparents lived out in Palos Verdes, and we would go and visit them, you know, every Sunday or sometimes during the week or whatever. But during Laker season, we would basically start watching a Laker game there and then have to head back because my grandparents were old and they went to bed early. So we would have to listen on the radio on the way home. And the way Chick Hearn, like, I don't, people always talk about this, and it's one of those things that usually I kind of fight back against some forms of nostalgia that like everything was greater back in the day. This is one of those things that anybody who fights back on Chick Hearn's coverage of the team is just objectively wrong. He was so freaking good. He put you in the building. He was funny. My favorite aspect of him, and it's something that I kind of carry with me now in my coverage of the team, was that if there was something that needed to be said about the way that the Lakers were playing or a certain player was playing, or he used to coach from the broadcast booth, he was like, "We need a sub. We need a..."
You know? No announcer ever had more clout than Chick Hearn had.
He was so good. And I can take me back to, I'll watch old games on YouTube, and I'll listen to Chick Hearn call those games, and it'll immediately shoot me back to those old days when I'd be riding home in the old red Ford Aerostar that my family had at that time. And we used to, my dad and I would like cheer. We would applaud in the van. We couldn't help ourselves because he was so good at putting us in that situation that it felt like we were in the building watching those games.
Yeah. For me, it's no coincidence that Chick is my avatar on Twitter and on like several different platforms. He was immensely influential. It's funny you bring up your grandparents. I always felt like Chick Hearn was my grandpa. Mm-hmm. My grandparents died when I was fairly young on both sides. So I didn't have, and when they were alive, you know, a couple of them lived a long way away. So I didn't really have grandfather or grandmotherly type figures in my life. And Chick was that in a lot of ways. My dad worked for the TV coverage for the Lakers, right? So he worked with Chick he got to, and you know, they used to call the production the Chick Hearn Show. That dude ran it. He was in charge of everything, and he knew everything that was supposed to happen from the technical side to the on-air side. And even like you said, he'd put, you know, be like, "We need a sub," and he'd so say good. Like, they couldn't, his old saying was, when they were playing like crap, like, "They couldn't beat the Sisters of Mercy right now," right? Like a bunch of nuns, right? And yeah, he always told it like it is. And but in terms of like, for me, why he's influential in my coverage of the Lakers is his attention to detail and his description of detail. They did a simulcast back in the day on KCAL, and
he's
on
the last ticket. Ever simulcast,
right?
They don't do that anymore.
And what that means is he was calling the game for TV and the radio at the same time. So he was very descriptive. One thing that really bothers me about the way that modern games are announced is so many of the details are left out. He would, you know, if you ever listen to me do the Laker film room live stuff, I tried my best as a novice to copy that, like every little thing that I saw, to try and explain like what was going on with that. He would say how far away the jump shot or the shot would be taken, like, you know, jumper from 19 or whatever. so that people would know when they were listening to their cars on the radio, like you were. So yeah, for me, Chick is, you know, he is my, I always say basketball looks like Magic Johnson on a fast break, and it sounds like Chick Hearn.
That's great. He also looked like one of the Muppets, like one of the old guys.
One of the old guys, yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick second here, and when we come back, we're just going to keep on rolling. We're going to keep this thing going. All right, what's next on your list here?
So, before I go any further, obviously Kobe's 81-point game is the pinnacle of regular season moments for anybody. I'm not going to get into that just because it's been covered and we've reflected on it so many times. But just obvious hat tip to that's, for me, the greatest regular season moment of all time. But along the same lines, Kobe had 65 in a game, in an overtime game against Portland. And that was the second highest point total of his career, and I was at that game, and that was during a period of time where I couldn't afford to go to Laker games, right? So I'd go to one or two per year, and it is, I grew up as a sports fan, right? Baseball, I'd go to a lot of baseball games, football games, basketball. That is the single best individual performance I've ever seen at a sporting event. And the Lakers were down by like 7 with about a minute to go in regulation. Kobe brought him back, and then in overtime he hit the best shot I've ever seen in a basketball game. And it wasn't, you know, there are some shots that take a certain amount of luck, right? It wasn't like a, the reason I say it's the best shot is because it was the pinnacle of all of the skill work that he did. It wasn't like a lucky heave from 60 feet or anything.
It wasn't the Miami shot, you know.
Right, exactly, against Dwayne Wade, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't bank in like that shot did. It was 100% pure skill where he was hot, and so they're putting two guys on him, and they're playing ball denial on an inbound play, if I remember correctly. Maybe it wasn't an inbound play, but they're playing ball denial on Kobe, and he catches it, like he does a V-cut off of his defender, and then he catches it, and he jabs one way, and he pivots the, quote, wrong way. He pivots away from where his pivot foot was. Mm-hmm. To a shot in the corner and hits this like fadeaway three going out of bounds. That was just, my description didn't do it justice, but if you look that up on YouTube, to me, that's the best shot I've ever seen in an NBA game. And that kind of culminated the best performance I've ever seen at a sporting event was Kobe 65 to lead the Lakers to a victory 2007 against Portland Trailblazers.
He's the best shot maker in the history of basketball.
Yeah, agreed.
Best. I mean, general shot maker, but like especially bad shot maker. He was so good. I mean, that's why people yell Kobe when they throw stuff in the trash. Like it's, you know, and you try to do all the pivots and stuff. That was great. Mine is actually kind of linked to yours here, and just like Kobe generally killing Ruben Patterson.
Like, the Kobe stopper.
Here's one of my favorite things across all of sports, all of athletics, is I like somebody who has the gall to say that they're going to kick somebody's ass, or like there is a perception that they're going to kick somebody's ass, and then they go out and do it, right? When everybody is expecting, when everybody is watching this, when you're focused on this exact dynamic in the course of a game, and they go out and they live up to their word. That's why, like, I clowned – Harrison and I laughed for an entire first segment at John Wall and the Washington Wizards because they went out there, they talked their shit, and then they didn't back it up. They look like they look like losers, right? And Kobe, you know, Patterson's out there. He's getting his feet rubbed before the game by – I forget who was doing that. Do you remember who was doing that?
I do not.
Oh, man. I can hear it in my mind. He's like, Kobe, stop. Kobe, stop. Kobe, stop. And he's rubbing his feet, and he's rubbing his feet, and Patterson is like playing into it. And then Kobe goes out and just fucking torches him.
Yeah.
And it was just and he did that to any number of anybody who dared challenge him. He would make it a point to go out and make that guy look like an idiot for daring to challenge Kobe. And I think there's, I don't know how what we would even call the analysis of what we would, you know, how we would define this, but that's a special talent to call your shot and then back it up. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, that was, there's more to Kobe's, like, for me, Kobe is my favorite Laker of all time, and it goes beyond stats and numbers and accomplishments and things like that, in that, so part of like what it takes for me to make the videos and stuff that I do is a very singular obsession and kind of a sacrifice of other things in my life, right? In order to put the amount of time in that I've put in over the last couple of years to do what I do. I learned that from Kobe. I don't have like an older brother or anything mm-hmm. like that. Like, it was this guy that I looked up to that was like singularly obsessed with what he wanted to do. And that always really fascinated me. And so the ability, and then just like the, when things don't go right, like for me, this is off topic because it was a finals game. One of my favorite Kobe games is the 6-for-24 game in the game 7, because it's not about like your best field goal percentage and efficiency, and I respect those things, and those things are important and all of that, but part of it is like, how can you figure it out when you're not at your best, when you have to fight through obstacles? Can you find a way to still make it work? And he got all those rebounds in that game 7. He drew free throws, and, you know, he figured out a way to make it work. And so like against Ruben Patterson and against guys that stepped up to challenge him, whether or not he won that fight or not, and he won way more than he lost, that wasn't the whole point to me. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. So. I appreciate the shout out. I too fight through adversity. I played those 30 holes, and I'm carrying myself.
Power through, baby.
What all right, we're going to take Mamba mentality.
Right.
We're going to take a quick second here, and when we come back, we're going to keep it going. We're just going to keep on having fun here, so stick around. So I know one of the ones that's on your list, and it kind of coincides with the one that's on my list. For the sake of time here, so that we cover our entire list, I'm going to combine Magic's comeback game, which you told me was on your list, and the All-Star game in 92, right after he announced, because there's a similar reason why those two games were so special. I'll let you talk about either one or both.
Well, I'll talk about the comeback game just because, you know, as everyone knows, Magic retired suddenly in November of 1991. And it's, I guess, the best for younger fans, the best way I could put it is, imagine if in 2008, going or the beginning of the 2008-2009 season, Lakers had just lost to the Celtics in the finals that June. They were going into the next season. You kind of like retooled. You're ready to make that championship run in 2009. And then like the first week of the season, Kobe retires.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine like the change in the history of the Lakers franchise, or just like how traumatic that would be as a fan. And not only does Kobe retire at the time, you think Kobe's going to die.
Yes.
Right?
That's like, the big one here.
We thought Magic was going to die.
Yeah.
With that diagnosis, like within like 18 months to 2 years. So it was like this guy that was your idol, your favorite player in all sports. Not only does he have to give up, right? He was like 31, 32 years old, and he's probably going to die. What the, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when he came back and when they announced it like a day or two before, I was like 15 years old and at the height of my like Lakers or my everything type thing, at least the teenage version of that, I did not sleep for like 2 days. And then he comes back and, you know, everyone knows the ball fake on Sprewell and all that. And but he was like, you know, he was a lot heavier and he was not the same guy, but it was just like, you felt, and I still feel like robbed of some years of Magic's career.
Oh, yeah.
And we all do, right? But like just to see him play one more time, man.
I think the other thing too with it being HIV was that it's an ugly disease. Like, it transforms somebody. They become ghosts. Like, they literally wilt away before your eyes. And you thought, crap, this is gonna happen to the brightest star that Los Angeles has produced in terms of athletics, and maybe even period, right? And to see him come back, and then in that game, that All-Star game, when he comes back from that, you had the shroud of you concern, is somebody else gonna contract it on the court with him, because Karl Malone said the dumb stuff that he said, by the way, screw Karl Malone, like, just forever, even as a Laker. But anywho, he came back, and he was legitimately, man, he was so freaking good in that game. And I watched, it was just on the other day. You and I talked about it briefly. It was just on the other day, and you know, he had a moment with Isaiah Thomas where he was guarding Isaiah Thomas. He had a moment with Michael Jordan. He had a moment with, like, everybody on the court. He had that one big three to kind of sort of seal the game. It was just – it was so incredible. And it really served as a reminder that this dude was damn near the peak of his powers and also was probably going to age really well in the NBA because he was a bigger, really skilled guy. He could have been a stretch four alongside Shaq if that would have overlapped.
Yeah, the only other guy that has had the combination of size and basketball IQ that Magic had is LeBron James. Mm-hmm. Like, we usually associate that with your John Stocktons and your Steve Nashes and, like, these guys who, if they didn't have that, they wouldn't have played in the NBA, right? Like, they had to have this preternatural, otherworldly ability to process information in order to get there, right? Mm-hmm. Well, like, LeBron could just have been an athlete with a normal basketball IQ and would have been a great player, right? Magic was less of an athlete, but still would have been able to do that. So yeah, like he was his, you know, he would have aged well. Yeah, I'm like going back in time and like in my mind and just like I'm a little like sad and still bitter at those lost years, you know, and what could have been, you know, they made it to the finals the year before and then they didn't have a backup point guard. They'd signed Saddle Three to kind of shore up a really glaring hole on that team. You had Vlade and Eldon getting a little bit older and now Worthy and those guys.
Worthy hurt his hamstring, right? That really hurt them. And
yeah. And now, do they beat the Bulls that ended up going to win six titles? Probably not, but we were kind of robbed of the opportunity of that. So yeah, it's tough, man. It's tough to think of that All-Star game and that comeback game in that respect.
And it just makes, like, I wrote this at the time when he sealed the deal with LeBron. It makes him landing LeBron all the more special because here we are 30 years after that. After thinking that we're not going to have this guy, and now he's here, and he's a big part of the fact that the Lakers are now back. That's pretty freaking cool. All right, what's your what's next on your list?
Well, just one last point on that. You know what I love, and I can say this as a fellow member of this, I love that Magic's fat. Like that Magic's fat now, right? Like he's like
he skips so like many leg healthy, days. Right? Magic, right. Magic, do some squats.
But just like with the whole like HIV thing and how you said like people kind of like wither away. Yeah. I'm like, man, like, and he's like in Italy, he's right? Living. Eating great Italian food and all that. Like, you go get it, Magic. You earned it, baby. As a fellow fat man, I respect it. So next on my list is it's a small moment, but it kind of typifies that late 2000s era team. Where they won the two titles. You remember the Shannon Brown block when he first touched the team?
It's one of the best gifs or gifs or whatever we're going to say it on Twitter when the whole bench goes, woo!
Yeah. It was like that moment of him doing that and then the bench's reaction to it. And then the crowd, like, because it was – Lakers were up by like 20. It was garbage time. They traded for Brown within the last week or two. And so he was just in kind of like cleaning up and – I forget who it was, made a bad pass. Atlanta jumped the passing lane. It was Mario West, I think, was the guy that did it. Goes up for like a layup, and then Shannon Brown, my God.
Swallows him.
And then all those Staples Center, like, I love that clip. The GIF or GIF or whatever is great, but the YouTube where you hear the sound of the crowd going, oh!
Yeah. It was holy shit. And then explosion, right? Like it was, did that just happen? Oh my God, that just happened. It almost made it better that they called a foul.
Right. So everybody got to rewatch it like three times. Every time Staples was like, oh.
Yes. That's a really, really good one. That was, man, Shannon Brown. You know, the dunk contest, I'm trying to move past that. But he was like, he, in my opinion, he had that dunk over Birdman in that Denver Nuggets series that I thought kind of sort of swung the series. It was because Birdman was such a force around the rim. He was blocking everything. And then Brown goes up and dunks him into the rim. And I thought like that was kind of one of those moments that, you know, helped swing a series. My next thing on here is while, you know, kind of perfect segue here, talking about dunks. You watch The Matrix, right? And it was perfect because Shaq, when he used to play the Kings, or when the Lakers used to play the Kings, they wore their black uniforms. And he would catch the ball, especially if he had deep position, and it seemed like everybody on the floor and some people from the bench, occasionally a fan would come down and try to mug him and make sure he couldn't dunk the ball. And to me, it kind of reminded me of The Matrix, where that, there's that scene where all of the Mr. Smiths or Agent whatevers kind of pile onto Keanu, and you kind of hear this like, poof, and then they all fly back, and he kind of like flies straight up. And you kind of saw that where Shaq would get the ball in deep post position, everybody would jump on top of him, and you'd hear this like, poof, and everybody would start flying off, and he would do his dunk. And unfortunately, this isn't a visual medium, but he didn't dunk it, you know, where his right hand goes over his left shoulder. He would dunk it where his right hand, his right shoulder would be closer to the rim, and he would dunk it with his right hand. And for some reason, that looked so much cooler as all of these kings were flying off. And it always reminded me so much of The Matrix, which was popular, about, you know, which had just come out. And it was just, it was such a cool visual that I never could get enough of.
That's great. And one of the things that added to the visual for me was like guys like Scott Pollard, who had, he was such like a early 2000s dude bro type of guy, like like the frosted tips and stuff. It was just so early, like late 90s, early 2000s type of guy. And just seeing him, and he's like this massive guy, right? Like 7 feet tall, just like, I said earlier in the year, like I actually met Shaq in person this year, and I never had before. And he's just like, you expect him to be the biggest person you've ever seen, and he's still just like, oh my God, when you see him in person. So
imagine having to guard that in the post.
No, I'm good, man. Like, and remember, people used to get Shaqitis, right? Like they'd be like, oh, coach, I've got back spasms tonight. I'm going to miss the Laker game.
They would, dude, there were multiple 7 foot stiffs that were employed just to be six fouls against Shaq.
Jim McElvain, man, he got like one of the biggest contracts in the NBA, came over from the Bullets when the Wizards were the Bullets. He had averaged the year before like 2.3 points a game and like 3 rebounds and like a block and a half. That was his thing, right? And he was like, you're big, you can guard Shaq. You're going to be the Shaq stopper. We're going to give you like the fifth highest contract in the NBA to put up 2 and 3. Yeah, that didn't work out.
In obviously. The 5 minutes before he fouled out. All right, what's next on your list?
Oh man, I think this is the last one of the five. Mm-hmm. Is the run? I want to say it was 2003 when Shaq was out, where Kobe went for the 10 straight 40 point games. Goodness.
Insane!
It was just like I don't know. I talk always about his like indomitability, and that was, to me, that was the best stretch of his career in a lot of ways, because he was still like all world defender too. Mm-hmm. So it was just this, he had a good like 5 year stretch where he was just like dominant on both ends of the court. And that was during, and then when he was, you know, putting up those numbers, the just every night in and out. And like, it was, I remember being like, all right, well, Kobe's going to get 40. So we can just depend on that. So how are we going to win this game? I said, like, 40 points was like what you took for granted. You wrote it into the box score and pen. How do we get the other 65 to 70 points that we need to win this game? Like, that's how good he was. Like, 40 was taken for granted.
My friends and I, we all play fantasy basketball. And one of our favorite things to do when we all have a few drinks is go back to old years or old stat lines or old averages over the course of a season and just think like how cool that would be to have that on your fantasy basketball team. So just imagine, like, your points are set, bud. Like, you're good to go. You can employ like 3 Bruce Bowens who aren't going to do anything and still be fine with points. So, all right. My last one before we get to the honorable mention is Powell's first game as a Laker.
Good call.
I don't think, now, I think Powell was generally underrated in the Laker fan base or whatever, and just generally, honestly, historically, I think he's really underrated. But the acquisition of Pau Gasol altered the course of the franchise, and I don't think you can overstate it. I don't think you can exaggerate the impact of acquiring, trading for Pau Gasol. Now, part of this, part of what went into that or why the course of the Lakers was changed was because Bynum came in and really impressed everybody and impressed Kobe to the point where before Bynum got hurt, it really looked – there was a game in Seattle where Bynum had a really, really good game, and Kobe finally kind of cracked a little bit and admitted that, okay, yeah, this team is making enough progress to where I can stick around. And then Bynum goes down, and you think, we just lost Kobe. Like, this is it. Like, he's going to want to play on Pluto again. And then they turn Kwame Brown and Javaris Crittenton and then a exponentially lesser known Marc Gasol into Powell. And we're back. We're back. And that first game, he had 20. So I went back and I went through, I watched some highlights of it, and I grabbed. Kobe only scored 6 points in Powell's first game.
Did he really?
He did. He scored.
Because they won that game, right? They won that game pretty handily.
Yeah, 105-90 over New Jersey.
And what I remember about that game is how seamlessly he fit in.
It was incredible. Normally,
it was like he'd been there for years, yeah. Right? And if I were to have an honorable mention on this list, it would actually be the first part of that season that you were talking about. That was the ship his ass out summer, right?
Yeah.
And Kobe was unhappy at the beginning of the year, and Dr. Buss was like, well, you got 3 more years on your contract, and you're Kobe freaking Bryant, so I'm not trading. Such a baller move. Let's figure it out, right?
Yeah.
But it was very uncertain. And then, so you have this team that was not that great. They were a low-level playoff team the 2 years before. And your best player by far is very unhappy to start the season. Kind of like recipe for disaster, right? Yep. And then they come out and they're super fun.
Yeah.
And Bynum, before he started having the injury problems.
Dunking everything.
Right, just emerged as this. And so that team at the beginning of the year, and then the bench was fun with Farmar and Sasha and all them dudes. Like, that team was so fun. And then Bynum gets hurt, like you said. And they made that trade for Powell like 4 days later.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it looked like you said, like that season was just going to be all for naught. They ended up in the finals that year. Yeah. And that was, like you said, that was the springboard. And Powell looked so damn good. And him and – I don't know if you've ever seen – they're talking about, I want to say, game 4 of the 2009 finals, and Powell is talking to Kobe, or Kobe's talking to Powell in the locker room about a pick and roll that they ran. Kobe's like, you were right there with me, right? Yes. Like, he's talking about staying parallel in the pocket.
I know exactly which play they were talking about. There was a play there. Maybe it's a different one, but there was a play where Kobe spun into the key, saw he didn't have a shot, and then threw a pass over his shoulder that hit Powell in the numbers, and he dunked it. And maybe it was a different play that they were talking about. But to me, that's one of the craziest plays Kobe's ever made, because I don't know how he saw him, and they just made it work.
And they're one of the great duos, both in terms of their on-court fit and then their personalities. I'll share the full story some other day, but Powell and Marc Gasol, when I was coaching high school ball, came to the high school for like an hour or two, and this is in South Central LA. And Mark, it was during the regular season. Mark had just flown in. We had somebody pick Mark up from the airport to come to this, so he didn't even like go to his hotel. He was super cool about it. But anyway, Powell is the nicest celebrity I've ever met in my life. And during that experience, you know, the kids, we kept it as a surprise for the kids, and so then Powell and Mark walk in, and they're like, ah, right, like everyone loses their mind, and. Powell especially. Mark's a little more shy than Powell is, but Powell looked every kid in the eye when he got to talk to them individually, like listened to them, made them feel important. And juxtaposing his personality, like Kobe needed a guy like him as his second option type of guy, personality wise too, right?
To Yang or whatever.
And Powell needed Kobe too, right? Like, Kobe would always try and bring. Remember the black swan? I need the black swan, not the white swan, out of Powell. And so to me, like, I don't know, man. Like, I always look back fondly on not just their pairing on the court, which was beautiful, but those personalities I thought really got the best out of each other.
Yeah, this game, Powell's first game, they're doing John Ireland is doing the post game interview with Powell. And Powell was surprised at how much he played and how much he was able to contribute. He had early foul trouble in that game and still kind of fought through it and was able to play really well. Kobe only has the 6 points. Kobe jumps in into the interview. And actually, even before Kobe jumps in, Fisher's kind of like walking from the end of the court that he was on. And you can just see it, like his back is super straight. You can see like there's this new energy with the team there. Kobe jumps into the interview and says, a mí me gusta, you know. And it was just this cool this cool feeling of like, fuck, all right, we're back.
Yeah, man. The first part of that season felt kind of like Cinderella, right? Like it was on borrowed time. Like it was super fun, right? But it was like, oh, this isn't going to last. Let's enjoy this while it lasts. When they got Powell, and even like you said, the vibe after that first game was like, yo, this is like a legit team now. Yeah. This is not like they're playing above expectations. Like this is real.
Yeah. And then I have an honorable mention here. We'll end on this one. It's so Kobe's last game. Everybody remembers Kobe's last game, dropping 60. It was one of the few times in since covering the team that I just went back to being a straight fan. I just fanboyed the hell out. He made that, you know, he made the free throws and he got, oh my God, he's got 40. Holy crap, he's got 50. Oh my God, he dropped 60. Gordon Hayward, you got to retire. And then,
the most illegal screens in NBA history that were not called were set by Julius Randle in that game. I want to point out.
Retire Randle's number just for those screens alone. But like, to me, that was special in and of its own. But remember, this was coming off of, we weren't sure we were going to have Lamar around for very much longer. And they showed Lamar at the game, and the stadium melted. There wasn't a dry eye in any of the houses watching this game. It was such an incredible, incredible moment. He gave his like shout out. We were surprised he was able to talk. He was walking. He looked good, you know, and it's just, to have somebody as great a person and as pure as Lamar was, and then it seemed like we weren't going to have him around anymore, and to have him come back and be able to take in this incredible moment in Lakers history, in basketball history, in NBA history, he's there to take that in courtside. That to me was, Kobe's 60 night was going to be special no matter what, but Lamar being there and coming back from what he was coming back from, that lifted it to an entirely new level that you know, I'll never be able to forget that.
Once a year, this is before I hadn't even dreamed of covering the Lakers in any way, my now ex-mother-in-law would get tickets from a client of hers that had season tickets since 1960 when the Lakers moved to LA, and he had moved up. It was, you're not even in the stands. You are the row of fold out chairs that's behind the Lakers bench. Mm-hmm. And she would give those to me once a year. And so this happened over the course of like 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's dream come true, right? For a Laker fan to be able to sit there. One of the things I always noticed is that Lamar Odom was the heart and soul of that team.
Yeah.
Like Kobe was a different dude. It was part of who
he was a driving force.
Right. And he was, I remember my girlfriend, this is later, I'd gotten the tickets after let's not get into my love life. I was with a girlfriend, but still getting the tickets from my ex mother-in-law. So I was not bad. And I guess, in this life, but, and my girlfriend at the time was not a Laker fan at all. But Kobe walked out, but she was a psychologist, right? Kobe walked out and she sees him and she's just like, he reminds me of a great white shark. And I thought that's my favorite description of Kobe.
That's a good one.
Like up close, especially, is he just seethed like just rage, right? All the time, which is great.
And he shot lasers out of his eyes that got Mike Brown fired.
Right. Pretty much. And so that's great. But like he does not relate as a personality to everybody else. That's part of what makes him great. Right. Lamar was the guy who tied that team together. He was the guy that everybody liked, that everybody respected, that, you know, and that kind of kept things light. And just as I said about how Powell kind of had this personality that complimented Kobe, if you had just guys like Derek Fisher and Kobe Bryant in a locker room, people are going to kill each other by the end of the year, right? Like Lamar was the guy who kind of kept things fun and kept things, you know, over the course of months and months at a time, being able to like coexist with each other. So being able to see him at that game at the end, especially with all of the personal problems that he's had and whatnot, yeah, it was a very special thing.
That was incredible. I just now remembered the preseason game that they played back at the Forum. That was also a really cool memory. If you guys have memories that you guys want to maybe mention or whatever, send them either to the iTunes reviews, send them to us on Twitter, and we can talk about that stuff like I said, August is a long month, and I'm going to hold off on this announcement for now until it's actually fully finalized. But you guys might like some news that might be coming down the pike here. It'll leave everybody on a high. I'll just put it that way. Pete, thanks again, man. Thanks for moving around your schedule. I appreciate that. Thanks for sharing these memories. This to me is what I think a cool aspect of this new version of coverage, where I don't think objectivity in sports coverage is possible. So just be a fan. just be a fan. Don't be a homer. Don't let it, you know, the way that you cover the team and the stuff that you won't say or will say about the team, don't let it paint your analysis. But cop to a bias every so often. I'm going to rock a purple shirt. It's always fun to wear the colors every so often. And we did in this show. I hope you guys enjoyed that. We'll be back at it again on Friday. And yeah, have a great rest of your day, everybody.